Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, and licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and an emotional worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Tuesday, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Donna. The first thing on my mind is that I love how you introduced the show as a time for our appointment with a reluctant therapist. I think we should make a permanent change to that because I like the flow. So I think we should make a note and we'll let Brad know that Okay. Officially moving on, that's the intro. I enjoy that. The other thing I enjoy is that you refer to me as an emotional worker, which is funny because my husband would probably say that I'm an emotional worker, always working with my emotions. But an emotion worker is someone who is responsible for, in the family system, taking care of all of the emotion work, like setting up play dates or doctor's appointments or the social calendar or hearing the stories of everyone in the family. They're the caregiver. So the emotion worker is a basic caregiver, and they usually partner with a resource worker, who is the person who brings home the bacon. You know, most family units, we do both pieces. We do a little resource work and a little emotion work. But I love the emotional part, too.
Good to know.
So today I have guests in the studio, which is always fun to kind of take us on a journey exploring. I don't want to be cryptic about it. I kind of want to be cryptic, but not totally cryptic about what we're going to talk about. But let's just say talking about one of the many ways we can find our way to our heart. And finding our way to our heart is kind of that key path to healing. Because when we think about mental health care, you know, it tends to get lumped into the field with Western medical model medicine, that we think of mental health care the way we think of physical care, that we start to have symptoms and so we address the symptoms and that takes care of the issue. But mental health care really isn't like that. Yes, we'll have symptoms, you know, things that maybe feel anxious or feel depressed or have ruminating thoughts. We definitely have symptoms, but it's very rare that you can address the symptoms and then go back to the way things used to be, right? And you can't take an antibiotic for 2 weeks and then your mental health is fine. It's very different. And one of the pieces of emerging work in the last, you know, 20 years, we've talked about that gut biome connection to the brain and how what we eat and our nutrition impacts our moods and mental health. But there's also a lot of research showing kind of that heart connection to our brain and that heart connection to our mental health. And this idea that maybe instead of focusing on how I feel about things in my head, right, how my brain is responding to how I feel, because our brain can fool us often, right, can make us believe things that aren't true, or help us, you know, believe things that maybe should be true. But our brain isn't always our best source of knowledge or information about how we're doing overall. But our heart, right, that center of our chest, that center of our being, kind of that core space, some people might even call it our soul, but that heart space is really essential in understanding how well our mental health is operating. Because we can get up and function and get things done when our heart is broken and we're grieving, right? We can still be in relationship with others when our heart is struggling. But when we tend to our heart, we tend to find improvements in all areas of our life. So if we work with the grieving heart, you know, give it time and space, let the heart be heard, let the tears flow, talk about how we're feeling, those are soothing things for the heart. And I don't know if I'm making sense, but you know, when we're going through grief, we can talk about the grief, but it doesn't necessarily heal the soul. The soul gets healed when the heart feels heard or the heart feels seen. And so today's conversation is about the relationship between horses and hearts and horses and human beings and how when we connect our nervous systems and our hearts with horses specifically, a lot of research has shown that syncing up of these two hearts can be incredibly healing. And you can't measure it through talking about it. You know, if you talk to people, and we'll get deep into it today, but what I found to be interesting is, and I've talked to many people who do equine therapy in some form or another or work with horses, And when I say, how do you know that things are better, or what is healed, or what is different, it's very challenging for people to specifically understand what that is. You know, my symptoms are gone, but it's different than that. Or, you know, I feel more alive, but it's different than that. You know, there's something really rich that happens when you have healed on a cellular level, when your heart feels whole. That's beyond words. It's an unconscious sense of wellness. And so we're going to talk about that. And my guest today is Kimberly Carlisle, and she is the co-founder of Flag Ranch in Paso Robles. And we're going to get some insights as to her journey to finding her heart amongst the horses and how she's sharing that with others today. So that's a brief overview of where we're going today and what we're going to be talking about. And I also want to remind everyone, as I said last week, that it's such a great time to nurture our hearts, because we're getting to get ready to go into the holiday season. It can be fraught for a lot of people, especially given kind of the nature of our social constructs right now and our cultural challenges. It's a really good time to kind of protect our wellness, but not hide out. Because I think for a lot of people, their first instincts when things get really tough is to retreat, right? To pull back in, to not want to have to engage with other people or show up to family events or have tough conversations or have to face what's happening. But that instinct to retreat and pull back shrivels our heart. I always think of, you know, the Grinch. When the Grinch is still crying, he escaped and went and lived in his cave because he didn't want to have anything to do with all the joy and happiness or things that were going on around him. And that was it's a great metaphor, analogy for what we tend to do as human beings when we feel hurt or angry or disappointed, is we retreat and we shrink. Our heart shrinks up. It becomes more brittle. It becomes harder to permeate. And so the only way that we can really continue to be healthy and move forward and have hope is to keep our hearts open, is to be willing to take some shots to the heart, right? Get our feelings hurt or feel disappointment. But also we have to have our heart open so when love comes our way or hope comes our way, we can also absorb that as well. And there is, again, some sciencey research that shows when we retreat and our heart feels broken and we move further away from community, the left ventricle actually gets smaller and we can feel actual heartache in our bodies. And so part of our job, our duty as human beings, is to give our heart the opportunity to feel all things, to feel the love that comes in, but also to experience hurt and recognize that it can also be healed. But we don't want to retreat and we don't want to shrivel up and we don't want to back away, because that in the long run harms us. So that's my tidbit for this week as we, you know, continue getting ready for the holiday season and gathering with others and talking about how we're feeling. Check in with your heart. You know, are you tending to this space that kind of holds you in relationship to yourself and to the world? So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you can be part of our conversation in multiple ways. Today, we will open up the phone lines, and you can give us a call at 805-781-3875. But you can also send me a message after the show to Elizabeth at thereluctanttherapist.com, or find us on Facebook and Instagram and send a message to me that way, and I'm happy to respond. And you can also share the show by podcasting. Go wherever it is you find your podcast, search for A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, hit subscribe, and our show will be there for you to listen at your convenience. And also, it's great if you leave a review or pass it on to friends so we can grow the show. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and start our conversation today. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
She's a good girl, loves her mama, loves Jesus in America too. She's a good girl, is crazy about Elvis, loves horses and her boyfriend too. It's a long day living in Reseda. There's a freeway running through the yard.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Welcome into the show today. My guest is Kimberly Carlisle. Hello, Kimberly.
I'm so happy to be here. I'm such a fan of you and this beautiful show.
Now you're making me anxious, but thank you. I'm glad you're here. It's always fun to meet someone new, and we actually have a lot of things in our life story that kind of cross over, which is always fun as well. Kimberly, I don't know how to start with your great bio, but I'm just going to tell from the story bottom up, and then we'll fill in. Does that work? So Kimberly is a co-founder of Flag Ranch. And Flag Ranch is a home to over 50 horses who are specially cared for and free to roam amongst their herd. It's a sanctuary for horses. It's also for humans, creating a unique collaborative environment. Flag Ranch offers herd immersions, which we're going to talk about today, where people walk among the horses, observing and interacting with them. Flag Ranch is considered a learning laboratory, a space for those seeking personal and professional development, an opportunity to experience the transformative power of horses. And Kimberly came to Flag Ranch 3 years ago, but prior to that, started off her career as a 1980 Olympian and a graduate of Stanford University in 1983. Kimberly is an advocate for human awakening to our impact on animals, the planet, and each other. Through writing, speaking, photography, and filmmaking, Kimberly tells stories that restore understanding, respect, compassion, and empathy among all beings. This was catalyzed, that's not my word. I'm looking at my own words. It's catalyzed by her experience of the 1980 Olympic boycott. And I kind of want to say yay for coming into the show and talking, because I know it's anxiety provoking. But let's start with the Olympic experience and kind of how all of your life events brought you to creating Flag Ranch.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. I'm actually practicing what we'll talk about, the benefits of being in a herd with horses and how they regulate to have breath and space and stillness. So this is really good practical application when you're speaking.
Yes, it is.
And on the radio.
To feel measured and metered.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here. Thank you. So the way I like to tell the story, swimming and horses are intertwined for me.
Okay.
Flag and I say, are retired racehorses. And Flag the horse is my co-founder in Flag Ranch.
Okay.
And he came off the track, and I came out of the swimming pool. But if you back up before we met, which was in my 30s, which was about 30 years ago, I was a young girl in South Florida, and I had started swimming when I was young. And I would go back and forth from my house to my grandmother's and pass a training track for the thoroughbred racing. Oh,
which part of Florida then?
South, Fort Lauderdale, Boca Raton area.
Okay.
And I would pass by the tracks. I never went in to see them race. I always worried about them. Mm-hmm. And I watched their training thinking, we train alike. We race, pace, recover. There's a guy out there, you know, the coach with splits and, you know, taking your times. And I thought, wow, that's a horse and I'm a girl and we're both athletes.
Yeah.
Fast forward, right? Go on with life. I'm at Stanford, freshman, make the Olympic team, 1980. The games were in Moscow. The Soviets were in Afghanistan, and we stayed home. Lots of grieving there.
Yeah.
But as I came through that, what I understood was that there are people on the planet with far worse plights than an Olympic athlete who couldn't swim in her games. And it invoked much compassion and a desire to make a difference in the world beyond just my own accomplishments. Mm. That it moved towards service and away from a resume, for example.
Can we back up to that experience before of the grieving? Because you had been training since you were probably, 8, 9 years old?
Five.
With
but
this,
not really for the Olympics. Right.
But at what time? Let's say you're swimming. In high school, maybe you started thinking, this is something I could do.
Yeah.
And what was that like you had the trials, you knew you were on the team, you knew where you were going. What was that experience to have it all pulled out? And a lot of people said, why didn't you just train for 84?
Good questions. Devastating.
Okay.
And I was in the middle of an extraordinary opportunity to be a Title IX benefiting female athlete in 1979.
Yes.
To get a full ride to Stanford University, which my family would have never been able to afford, rocked my world. I came out of South Florida and parts of Florida where women were not celebrated. We were smart, athletic women were ostracized. Mm-hmm. And to come to a place where we were celebrated, it was paradigm shifting. Mm. So that, I was super grateful for that and super into that. So of course, the Olympic Games happened in between freshman and sophomore year, and I had a lot of work still to do and a lot of benefit to reap and a lot of learning. I came to study. I really did. Mm-hmm. As much as to swim.
Yeah.
And so
you don't want to squander Stanford, right?
No. And 84 was right after I was going to graduate. So, of course, I kept swimming. We won two national titles, the first one in Stanford's history.
Wow.
For women's swimming.
Wow.
And that carried through to 1983. And then, not to get too deep into it, but rules changed. There was not a vision to keep swimming after college at that point for women.
Oh, okay.
And I had to get a job. So I decided to retire at the end of my college career and didn't even try to make the 84 team.
So that is a big difference, because today there's a whole professional circuit, correct?
I mean, women are swimming, yeah. Men and women. I mean, yes, you can make money, so you don't have to worry about that part.
Right.
There are women swimming through and competing well after childbirth. There are women swimming at world-class levels into their 30s. So the vision for what's possible evolves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also, having been a Title IX person, yay, it was pretty revolutionary, because when women weren't competing at that level, and most of the institutions weren't prepared for women to come be competing. So I'd imagine they were not prepared for anything happening after college, because I think in one of my sports, our drill team instructor was our soccer coach, because they didn't even have people available to you know, facilitate that kind of level of competition. And I think still, and I'd love to know your take on this, but I graduated from college in 1983 as well. Mm-hmm. And there was still enough of that, it's time to settle down and start your family in society, even though we'd been through that second wave feminism and right Title IX, I still felt a lot of that. Okay, well, you did your thing, and now get married, have kids.
Yeah, and that, I think that's right. It's sort of a dual pathway. Because I was at a place where you also went to work.
Yes,
and a lot
that
at
was
that
moment.
Point, a lot of people mm-hmm. were going to Wall Street and other things. And I was, you know, I wanted to write, I wanted to broadcast, I wanted to do something a little different. And I wasn't ready yet to settle down. I did have that vision for myself that I would be a little older mm-hmm. By the time I started a family. But interestingly enough that you bring it up, because I did meet the father of my children that senior year. So that was a factor in deciding to move on with my life.
Yeah. And I don't know how much that's really changed, but I definitely felt that pressure. It was hard to say now my career will be swimming for the next 10 years. And as you mentioned, that idea of broadcasting, Donna DeVerona was the only woman broadcaster at that time. So that really wasn't an option either, to say, I'm going to jump into that.
No, there was one cable TV station down the road on the San Francisco Peninsula near Stanford, and it collided with swimming practice. So I ended up writing, mm-hmm. Which is my true love still.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Kimberly Carlisle. She's a co-founder of Flag Ranch in Paso Robles, and we're talking about her journey to shifting her focus from being an Olympic athlete to doing more heart-centered work and tending to others. And I guess the fulfillment of that dream has been starting Flag Ranch 3 years ago. So you leave Stanford and you retire at the ripe age of 22 from competition. What's the next steps for you then?
I went to work, okay. as I knew I needed to, mm-hmm. and have still continued to work professionally in the communications realm. It's gotten more strategic and creative and multi-channel, as the channels have opened from that one, you know, print media or the cable TV back right. in 1983 to what's, oh my goodness, what's available now. So life goes on. And then I did marry that fella that I met just before I got out of Stanford. I had two beautiful children. And in my early 30s, I ran into a friend at the local coffee shop in Menlo Park, California, who said she had just adopted a horse off the track. And I felt my whole body being go, uh-oh.
Oh, wow.
And a year later, Flag came into my life. And
you weren't a rider, right, at
no.
that point?
Okay. No, I learned, he taught me to ride. But what he really taught me was to be in relationship and what was in the partnership and the friendship, multi-species, bringing it all the way back to when I was a little girl mm-hmm. at eight and felt a kindredness with thoroughbreds mm-hmm. on the track. So we just kind of hung out together while I was raising my kids. And as time went by, I started getting brave. Remember, I said I didn't want to watch the horses race. It worried me.
Yes.
Even though it was thrilling and they were beautiful mm-hmm. And magnificent athletes, I was worried for them. And now I know why. And I learned quickly why. And I started looking at the underbelly and being able to take in what I was learning about what was happening to the horses and the jockeys, for that matter, mm-hmm. as that sport got more and more commoditized. And horses are discarded by the thousands out of that business. And I thought, oh my, I have to do something. And then meanwhile, in parallel to that, I started noticing the emergence of what I would call, in an umbrella way, the equine-guided education, if you will. Mm-hmm. And it ranges from everything from deep therapy to leadership and teamwork, okay. mounted work, mm-hmm. and then on-the-ground work. Some places, some schools, some prisons in the United States started seeing the value of having students and inmates care for horses and how transformative that was an experience in just the simple care of these large and beautiful beings. And all of a sudden, the light bulbs went on. I thought, oh, there's all these horses needing a home and a purpose. And there's this beautiful new partnership emerging between horses and humans mm-hmm. in human well-being and development, different than fighting a war or hauling lumber or taking us from place to place or being in a show ring or just being a trail mate.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, being of service, that there was this other kind of service that was emerging. And that got my whole body tingling. And that's when I thought, okay, that's what we're going to do. We're going to embark. We're going to start taking in horses off the track, and we're going to offer people the experience to immerse with them.
Was it difficult to be able to rescue horses from the track? Because I would imagine they didn't want people to know that the horses were just being discarded, right? And so if you were to say, I'll take those horses, in some ways it would out the fact that the horses were being euthanized.
That's a beautiful, important question. I would say that by the time we heard about horses needing placement, they were far from the people who had brought them into the service or into the sport, and they really didn't care, I'm sorry to say. Mm-hmm. So it was people who heard about a horse needing. So there's, I think of there's a fleet of angels out there mm. on behalf of all beings, really, on mm-hmm. the planet. I still have hope mm-hmm. that we
Your
are all out
open.
There working hard
on
the
open.
Pieces that matter to us. And in this case, people would hear about a horse and we'd get a phone call or an email. I did not go directly to the racetracks. I still have not been able to go to an auction house. I can't handle that energetically, but there are some incredibly brave men and women who do. Hats off. So we're a next stop.
Okay.
We get calls and emails. Can you take this horse? And that's been actually we started 20 years ago, but we moved to Paso 3 years ago.
Okay.
So
where was the original sanctuary?
We started on the peninsula, San Francisco Peninsula, and then kind of as the herd grew, we needed more pasture and we had to go farther afield because part of the challenge, you know, we all used to have a relationship with a horse, but we've lost places to actually have them reside because they need land and space. And so between development, guest houses, tennis courts, vineyards, they're just getting more and more marginalized. So as we took more horses, we moved to places farther afield to have more acreage.
Gotcha.
Because we wanted them to be able to be horses and herd on the land mm-hmm. and be live as natural a life as grazing animals as possible.
What's the biggest challenge for the horses that are rescued coming into herd?
Well, it's so topical to this your work, not reluctant therapy, but incredibly mm-hmm. beautiful. I mean, we all come to therapy in a way that's just, we know we need it.
Mm-hmm.
Horses, mm-hmm. Something similar happens where somebody knows a horse needs some different life for whatever the reason. And so we get the call, they arrive in our herd, and whatever was ailing them, usually they drop.
Just once they're put into the herd?
They just drop it. The things that we hold on to, we can hold on to story, we can hold on to pain, we hold on to grief, they just seem to drop it, which is part of the beauty of the work, which is their inherent nature, is to be present to what is. So if they're suffering, they're enduring the best they can. But once that's removed, they resume their natural, joyful, curious, present selves.
It's and then almost they like get their heart is waiting for that opportunity.
Their heart to stay open.
Right. It doesn't shrink, as we talked about at the beginning of the show.
Nope. Yeah,
they're able to somehow still trust and connect.
That's one of the pieces that amazes me the most. They still trust, and they are so patient, and they're just waiting for us to notice and to change our ways and to see their qualities and their values and their gifts.
So you talk about your work as a writer and that you're still actively writing and working in corporate world. How did this whole other part of you with, you know, building Sanctuary for the Horses, how did you have time or even the energy or know-how to do this?
24/7? No, I do sleep.
Good.
I do feel like I have high capacity, not manic energy, but broad energy.
Athlete energy.
Yeah, and perseverance. You keep working at something. You're not doing it all at once. You keep working at something little by little by little until you build something. We started out, our first horse came in 2005. Her name is Glitter. She's still with us. She's 31 years old. And now we have 50, as you said at the introduction. But that grew over 20 years. Mm-hmm. And we've had 30 more pass through our care. We're a sanctuary for life. So one of our other really important practices is hospice for horses.
Okay.
Because their elder years are, it's daunting in their big bodies and their needs. And a lot of people, it's hard to see. So it takes, just like with humans and our other beloved animals, it takes, you have to be brave to stay through and witness that arc of life. So, you know, we've touched 80 horses in 20 years. Seems like in some ways a slow boat, but on the other hand, they live a long time and and there's a long relationship there that's really important to us. You know, it just grew over time. And meanwhile, my kids were growing. And meanwhile, my work was growing. And I think I could bring it back to what my dad, who was my coach, used to always say when I was young. So it brings it back to the athletic career. Three realms are important: your studies, your athletics that you choose to do, and your social life and your family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always able to move between these three really important places with balance. And that's still true.
Were your children involved in connecting with the horses?
My son, they loved Flag. They really only knew Flag before they went off to college.
And how long
this
did
really
Flag
start
live?
To grow. He died in 2017. He was 34 years old.
Wow.
We were together 21 years, and it was one of the best partnerships of my lifetime. So far.
That's good. I like the hope at the end. What is the average lifespan of a horse?
A thoroughbred, a good long life is 30.
Really?
A draft horse, it's like dogs. The bigger the horses get, the shorter the lifespan, maybe 20. And little ponies and minis can live till they're 40.
Wow. And so now that you've kind of built this, is Fike still your primary? Is it your primary focus? Or
it's
is
an
it still
and.
Your hobby energy?
It's still an and. It's my advocacy. It's my passion. It's my love. It's my it's my devotion.
I love that. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm speaking with my guest, Kimberly Carlisle, who is the co-founder of Flag Ranch, which is a home to over 50 horses who are specially cared for and free to roam amongst their herd. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we are going to take a quick break and come back and open up our phone lines for your calls, comments, questions. 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Tiptoed in a room. I know you got to have your rest. Says, come lay beside me. I've been waiting since you left.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist with my guest today, Kimberly Carlisle. So we've been talking about how you found your heart and your passion for protecting these horses and providing them sanctuary. So now you have these 50 horses at Flag Ranch. What is it that Flag Ranch does including caring for the horses?
Right. So the care of the horses is first and foremost elemental. But at a little higher level than that, what we are offering is safe harbor and a nourishing environment for horses and for people.
Okay.
And the way we do it is myriad ways that we do that, and myriad people are drawn to it. But it's as simple as coming to muck poop, okay. which can be very meditative, or fix fences or whatever your aptitude is, all the way to these deeper dive, experiential retreats, I would say. And they can range from a few hours to a few days. They can be individual to group to team to family. And they involved, I would say, layered exposure to being with horses in smaller groups and smaller enclosures, graduating all the way to being immersed in our herd of 17. We have more than one herd of the 50, but the largest group is 17, and they're mostly Mustangs, some of whom are still wild. Mm. And so it's an unintended exploration of allowing horses from all different backgrounds, different genders, different performance arenas to integrate, which is a beautiful model. And there's so much more we can talk about in terms of what they model that we can learn. But there's also an experienced feeling that's really the crux of the work, which goes back to how you introduced the show about being in our bodies and being in our hearts, because mm-hmm. that's where they naturally reside.
Yes. They don't shrink.
They don't. They don't even, there's not even a concept of that, because it's so innate to their well-being, survival, and natural state as mammals, but herd mammals and flight animals added on top of that, who have to perceive everything around them mm-hmm. to remain safe. Plus, there's the beautiful weave of a herd when horses are allowed to live in herd that forms this, it's a felt sense, a tapestry of breath and space and energy and affection mm-hmm. that is innate to them in their families.
So you talked about the coming together of the different types of horses. How, because it never really occurred to me that there, you know, there would be that adjustment to, I guess they're strangers to each other. So what does that look like? Do they develop hierarchies? Is there a pecking order? You know, or is it just an open come and let's all be a family together? Mm. How does that develop?
Beautiful question. So it's a balance between openness and strength. And so in the wild, horses need to be able to move fast together mm-hmm. To defend themselves. Also, they need to be able to move together to find resources, water and food. There generally isn't a lot of defense of one family to another, but there is some. I mean, there is a lead stallion mm-hmm. who guards his family, but there's also a lead mare who holds the well-being of the whole container. And so they're
the resource
different.
Worker and the care.
I was going to say at their mm-hmm. root, I think they are emotion workers. Mm-hmm. But yes, they have different roles that are great models for how we might model a family or a work team or our society at large. For example, one, going back to the strength, the strength has to be balanced, and it can't be aggressive, mm-hmm. and it can't be too weak. Mm-hmm. And so like a lead mare and a natural herd, and we see it, our herds are natural enough, even though they're not on thousands of acres, to see these enactments of roles. So the lead mare, when there's a young colt who's moving into teenagehood, we'll just use some metaphors of, from our lives, and he's too energetic, not respectful of space, not paying attention, she will call him out of the herd and push him out. Hmm. For a horse, that's life and death.
Social death. And
social death, for sure, but literally, perhaps, real death in the wild, okay? Mm-hmm. And then he has to learn, the young colt, to moderate his energy down, and she'll let him back in. Hmm. Likewise, we've had a couple of horses go blind at an older age. And if they show, I mean, horses are very stoic, and if they show that they can't navigate with the herd, the horses will call them out. So we've had to form some smaller sub-herds for those horses who've, in the wild, they would be naturally killed by a predator, which keeps the fabric and the weave more uniform. Mm-hmm. We have, as humans, taking care of horses, have more of an arc of care from birth to death.
Right.
Birth is easier because the babies will get up and run with the wild herds in the morning.
Right away.
They'll
yeah.
go with their mamas. But so that so you see that, but there's a health in there, an inherent health in the moderating of the group energy. But there's also a lot of beautiful expression, play, joy, curiosity. The young males often will just spar with each other. We call it stallion play. That is like it's like watching ballet. A choreographed ballet. So it's a rich, expressive social circle with plenty of individual expression, but that does not disrupt or threaten the sanctity of the herd.
So when people come to Flag Ranch, for whatever draws them to that, what kind of experiences are they having? I mean, I'm listening to you talk, I imagine the observing piece of the dynamic of the family would bring up a lot of feelings for people in our own desire to have connection and support and family. I can imagine that. But do people come in looking for that? Do you tell them you might have this experience? Or is it just a more organic experience?
Yeah, I think people who come know they're drawn to it.
Okay.
But they don't necessarily know why. Mm-hmm. Why they're drawn to this particular body of work that involves horses. I think the common denominator among all who seem to come to the work in whatever form is a disruption in their own sense of well-being, of harmony. Everything's speeding up. Everything's overwhelming. Technology is intense. Information is saturating. We are really residing, as you said at the top of the show, you know, we're residing largely in our from mm-hmm. our neck up.
Yep.
And so there's something out of order. We feel disconnected. We feel a calling for something we can't put our finger on. Mm-hmm. And then when they come, there's observation. But what's really pivotal is the dropping into our bodies. Of being able to feel what it feels like to be in a group of beings who are still and present and have breath and are just tuned to what's happening right in front of them. Who are you? What are you here? Are we safe? What do you smell like? You know, and it brings what's dysregulated in us into some regulation and gives us some breath and some space. And then what I think really happens then mm-hmm. is we start to reconnect to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We reconnect to love. We reconnect to wisdom. And all of our body intelligences, which I think we ignore in our society, they're not taught anywhere. Where is intuition taught? Really, where's deep creativity taught? Where's nonverbal communication taught? And where are we taught that energy and reading energy is valid?
Mm,
it's the horse's survival.
Isn't that interesting? And I can imagine that as well, that when people have the opportunity to step in and just be connected to their heart and their self. It's one, a little scary at first because we're taught not to trust ourselves. But then two, I would imagine once you've opened that space, the desire to continue being immersed with the horses or to be in that environment would be great. So how do people translate these kind of life-altering epiphanies at Flag Ranch into their lives after?
Exactly. Great question. And so one of my biggest passions is that this work, you dip in and you go back to your life.
Right.
You dip in, you go back to your life. Maybe it informs some changes in direction of your life. But I think a really good example, you asked me to think of someone who...
A specific outcome.
Mm-hmm. Really, you know, we can speak in general what happens. And it's a pretty universal experience. But there was a woman who came. This is a good example. It's one we can all relate to. It's not so. See, this work is beneficial for all of us, regardless of what the depth of, if it's trauma or just wanting to reclaim something.
Or loneliness.
Or loneliness, mm-hmm. the connection to others, but also self-connection. Mm-hmm. And so... the example I want to share, again, with confidence, is a woman who came to the ranch, a little bit older mom, so children entering teenhood, and she had chosen to be at home with them, beautiful, worthy choice, and yet it was starting to evolve that it was time for her to begin to consider what's next,
mm-hmm.
right? And so deeply entrenched in the logistics and the energies and the self-image of that role, there was really no room for her to even begin to mine what else might be there, mm-hmm. to be able to listen, to have that kind of space for reflection. And so for her, coming to the horses and then actually working through practices and guided experiences, guided exercises, if you will. I don't mean mm-hmm. it to sound so,
you know, formal.
There is structure, mm-hmm. but through that you develop breath. You drop into the body. Open your eyes. What's here? Walking among the horses. How do you hold your space? Mm-hmm. Oh, I have a right to have space, and sovereignty over my life and my body and my thoughts. You know, we give it over as mothers, right?
Yes.
And at some point, we begin to reclaim it. And so there's actual skills we learn. But you can feel, when you learn the skill, you feel it in the body. And so then what it's really important to us, I think pretty universally in this work as facilitators, is to have someone come and then be able to reactivate those practices wherever they are in their life and whatever circumstance they find them in. Just as I said, coming to sit in the studio here, remembering to breathe and drop in mm-hmm. and really listen mm-hmm. and then see what comes.
My guest today is Kimberly Carlisle. She's the co-founder of Flag Ranch in Paso Robles, and we're talking about her beautiful sanctuary for over 50 horses that they have rescued and are specially cared for. And people are able to come to Flag Ranch. You're all invited in some form to walk among the horses, observe, interact with them. And Kimberly refers to Flag Ranch as a learning laboratory, a space for seeking personal and professional development and to experience the transformative powers that Kimberly's describing of being with the horses. And this is a conversation with the reluctant therapist. All right, so we have my intern, Isabel, who's joined us today. And Isabel had the opportunity to go up to Flag Ranch last week and spend some time with you. So I'm curious, Isabel, what was your takeaway?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you, Kimberly, for that opportunity. And thank you, Elizabeth, for being here. But something that really stood out to me as someone who really doesn't have any experience or background with horses, I appreciated that it's not a place where people are riding horses. I found that to be a lot less intimidating for me, and that it is a place of observation and immersion. That was really intriguing. And, you know, I didn't get to experience the complete herd immersion that you do offer at Flag Ranch, but I got a little taste of what it's like and what the land is, and you talk to me a lot about the horses and how they're cared for and how special that is. But yeah, I specifically appreciated that the observation piece kind of takes away that power dynamic of horse and rider. And I think it allows people to connect with the horses and themselves on a different level when that isn't included, if that makes sense. Obviously, there's benefits and potential for therapeutic
by outcomes of some
sort. Yeah. There's, you know, that applied piece of equine therapy where people do ride the horses and experience them in that way. But what Kimberly does at Flag Ranch is a little different, and I like that.
Good. So there's a couple questions for you. One, are the stallions allowed to breed?
That's the golden question. So I did refer to stallion play, and what I meant by that is that the males enact what you would see stallions doing in the wild. But in the horse world, the primary way of the primary birth control is to geld. So that means to neuter the males. And so all of ours are neutered. That's a whole other topic, how that felt, especially to watch the neutering of a beautiful young wild Mustang, and that's a whole other conversation. But we are not breeding. We are the offsetting of overbreeding in the horse world. And so, no, but we want them to have a life where they can play those roles anyway.
And then are the Mustangs turned out with the thoroughbreds?
Indeed,
I don't know what that means.
Yes, and then that's what I was referring to earlier. We allow horses to choose their friends regardless of breed, gender, background, whatever performance arena we're in. We are unusual in that way. We follow the horses' leads and allow them to form bonds. And we, unless we have an extreme circumstance where there's an injury, or in this case of one who went blind, even then we would figure out which is their closest friend that could come with them if we have to move them to a space where they can't be out on the land dealing with ravines and big trees and things like that, that a blind horse may eventually come to be able to navigate, but under pressure in a herd, probably not the safest thing for them.
So who comes, you know, how do people find you, Kimberly? How do they find Flag Ranch, and who comes to be a part of this experience?
Well, the beautiful thing, I mean, I'm here as much to speak on behalf of the healing, transformative properties of the field of equine guided education. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people all over the world now, these really wonderful organic entities cropping up, whether it's one practitioner or a group of practitioners. And we're all offering different, you know, it might be mounted riding for handicapped people. It might be therapeutic for autism. It might be just the mutual care. It might be some of the personal to professional development we're talking about. So I would first advocate that wherever you are, wherever you're listening from, wherever you lived, I Googled again yesterday in preparation for today, seeing what would come up. Mm-hmm. If I Googled equine guided education, Paso Robles or wherever. And there's a whole beautiful menu, array of offerings. So like with anything else, you're looking for a school or a therapist or whatever, follow your instinct. This is a good practice. What are your instincts? Where are you called? What resonates for you? And follow that. So it's not just about Flag Ranch, but Flag Ranch, we are flagranch.org. We're in Paso Robles. We have a wonderful suite or team of guest facilitators. We're encouraging and opening. If someone's listening and or knows of us or comes across us, looking for if you're an equine guided practitioner looking for a place to practice, our horses are waiting. We do again simple things from volunteer days to a menu of offerings that are guided by human facilitators with the horses.
So people can go to flagranch.org and see a lot of different ways to get involved. And then what I'm hearing you say is then listen to their heart or what they feel drawn to anyway to participate. I also think it's interesting that you've created the sanctuary for the horses, but also in some ways a sanctuary for practitioners who might not have access to horses that they can, you know, share with their clients. So how did you, how did that come to be?
Yeah.
Well, one of the, rare.
Yes. Thank you. And one of the things I noticed early on as we saw the field emerging was that there were a lot of people who wanted to facilitate, whether it was therapeutic experiences all the way to more coaching and facilitating teamwork and leadership development. A lot of passion and qualifications for the work, but no place to practice because
right.
one of the more daunting aspects and the very expensive aspect is caring for the horses.
Mm-hmm.
And then caring for a large number of horses. The need is intense. There aren't, unfortunately, enough of us in the United States to care for all the horses that need a place to go. We all are working together hoping that we change the need for sanctuary over time. But meanwhile, this field is growing in similar ways. That's why I saw the marriage, which, mm-hmm. you know, the field is growing. Could we partner up horses who need a different kind of life, especially after performance? And every person can benefit from time with a horse on planet Earth. We used to all have relationships with horses. We've lost that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's coming back. So I think practitioners who want to bring clients and have a place to practice with horses is a wonderful way to open. You know, we have a small team. We're not staffing programming 7 days a week, you know, several months a year now. And we're very weather dependent too, because mm-hmm. we're wide open to the elements. But I think it's a great partnership because our goal is to care for as many horses as we can with balance, but also to bring the work to as many people as possible.
So how do you decide which horses to take in? Because I'm hearing that there are far more horses that need sanctuary than sanctuaries.
Yeah, it's a beautiful question. It's the profound question. And it's a bit of a Sophie's choice sometimes because when you get a call and we can't for some reason, I mean, we're full and most sanctuaries are full, and there's a network of us somewhat ad hoc trying to find placement. Even when we get a call, it's not, I'm sorry, we can't help you. We can't take him or her, but we can help you. But we decided some time ago in this sort of unfolding of our journey that the most at-risk horses in the United States are those who can't be ridden anymore. Can't, shouldn't, don't want to be. And don't want to be started. You know, there are people who work with wild horses to bring them along, but some of them will have nothing to do with humans. And so could we provide sanctuary for horses just to be horses without any need for any training, to your point, Elizabeth, or riding? We're not against riding, but we are for riding in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Not riding as a commodity, but riding from the depth of relationship, just like you would with a human partner, right? So we take now horses who have lost resources and who can't be ridden anymore because they're deemed to be of no more value, which
right.
is
no more use.
The thing that breaks my heart the most
mm-hmm.
is because they can't serve us. They're not worthy of living.
So in our last couple of minutes, Kimberly, can you describe what this experience in working with Flag and starting Flag Ranch, how it's informed or changed your life or you as a person?
Oh, you didn't put that question on my prep
notes. I wasn't going to warn you.
Thank you. That's a beautiful question. Engendered, I already felt I was a compassionate person, but boy, has this tested that,
mm-hmm.
especially when I have to look into some awful places where horses and other animals are suffering at the hands of humans. Empathic. I didn't realize how empathic I was. I think now looking back to when I was a girl, I had a kindred empathic sense that I did not even though I was an athlete in my body, I didn't think about those things and give them credit until now, really. And how intuitive I am, didn't think I was very intuitive either. And the horses have shown me that, oh yeah, there's a whole transmission of information and communication and senses that you do pick up on and you do need to trust. And I think everyone who comes, that's one of their big takeaways, is we are intuitive beings and we need to trust that.
And so what does success look like for you? you know, 3 years into it now, where are you going or hoping to be going with this?
Well, as we've touched on, I would love us to be a rich and open forum for exploration and development in this field, mm-hmm. for people who want to have a different experience with horses to come and not be seen as odd. I think at a lot of traditional barns, this kind of work is a little seen as a little strange, mm-hmm. but there's more and more. There was a beautiful story on Warwick Schiller here in Paso Robles in the New York Times this week about his moving the awareness toward the horse and what the horse is communicating, and that we're listening more than whispering, that we're the students and they're the teachers. But to be a local, regional, national destination for this work, but also working in collaboration with all the other enterprises to rise the tide for horses and for people.
So when will you get to retire and just live in your sanctuary?
Retirement has never been in my vocabulary. I've always admired Jane Goodall and Richard Attenborough and their work for advocacy. And why would I stop? There's so much to do on our planet right now.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kimberly.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Elizabeth.
And I appreciate having you here. Isabel, thanks for joining us today. Excuse me. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. If you'd like to find out more information, you can contact Kimberly through flagranch.org. You can leave me a message at Instagram or Facebook. I'm happy to reply. And listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. As always, thank you for tuning in, listening, and supporting our community right here at Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Childhood living is easy to do. The things you wanted, I bought them for you. Graceless lady, you know who I am. You know I can't let you slide through my hands.